Welcome to Federal Insights for January, Digital Transformation Month, sponsored by NEC Corporation.
Few technologies are advancing as rapidly as facial recognition. As speed and accuracy rise, so do the number of potential applications. The National Institute of Standards and Technology has been a consistent turn-to source for best practices, latest tech developments, and of course, standards. For an update, I spoke with NIST computer scientist and biometrics expert, Patrick Rother.
We've started maybe two or three different bits of work, one on quality assessment. Can you look at an image and say it's a good quality image? That's important to performance downstream. Another bit of work that we've been doing during the pandemic, obviously, is to look at, can face recognition work when somebody is wearing a protective face mask? And so we evaluated existing algorithms, pre-pandemic algorithms, and newer algorithms developed since the onset of the pandemic. We've worked on demographics. Does face recognition work equally well in different demographic groups? So that's three things. I'm sure there's some others, but that's the highlight. Yeah.
And let's talk about the face mask idea, because I suppose in a law enforcement or national security situation, and it would have been unusual to see someone in a face mask before the pandemic, you might have concluded, well, that person has something to hide. Now with people wearing en masse in public places masks, and might continue to for quite some time, that would seem to be a really high priority. And the question is, what have you discovered in that particular area of using just the eyes and the bridge of the nose?
Yeah, a few things to say. One, covering up the face was never going to be a good thing. You cover maybe 40, 50, 60% of the face, and it's a challenge to face recognition. And so what we found is that some algorithms really don't tolerate that at all. The error rates go up very high. But on the flip side, we found that some algorithms really are prioritizing the eye region of the face naturally. And so their accuracy, while it did decline, was still probably usable in an operational context without modification. And presumably those same developers could go forward and refine that and improve things a bit still further. But this is an ongoing bit of work that we're doing to track capability, you know, through the pandemic. Yeah.
Because so many agency applications, so many industrial applications are going to that low contact type of and low closeness type of idea to reduce some of the friction that happens in transactions involving people, screening situations. So that would seem to be kind of a high priority right now.
Yeah. I mean, a long-term goal of almost the whole biometrics industry beyond just face recognition is to make using biometrics easier. And you do that by allowing greater flexibility in how an image gets captured. So as you mentioned, this frictionless travel idea, where we can throw away a boarding pass and replace it with just your face walking through an airport from check-in to bag drop to the TSA line into an aircraft lounge and then boarding the plane. In principle, that can all be done with one-to-many face. So you just present your face, you're expected at various touch points through the airport, and you confirm your identity using just face recognition.
And I've probably asked this before, but I'll repeat the question. Has, in general, the mask business aside, has the twin problem mostly been solved by this point?
The twin problem has not really been solved. So, you know, the face is under control of genes that we inherit from our parents. And if you're an identical twin, obviously you look very similar to your sibling, to your twin. And largely face recognition will authenticate both of you as each other, which would, you know, in principle, allow you to travel on your sibling's passport.
So that has not been solved then. And in these industrial types of algorithms that are in use now, you said some of them do tend to have more data derived from the eyes than from the rest of the face. Is it possible that to keep migrating in that direction, given the mask situation, and is there a point at which there's no more information to be gained from eye information such that you can only get so good, or do we know that yet?
Yeah, I'm sure there are limits, but it's something that we shouldn't do at the moment is bet against the technology, because all the evidence over the last 5, 6, 7 years is that the accuracy gains are substantial and they continue. So we are just in the process of updating our ongoing benchmark report, and we can see further gains in accuracy, and particularly some developers are pushing the boundaries there. One possible opportunity for exploiting the face generally and the periocular region more specifically is to add higher resolution images. So if we use cell phones, the cameras have got a lot of resolution. Some of the cameras being deployed in airports nowadays have got quite a lot of resolution too. And with that resolution, you see more detail, and that potentially can give you better accuracy.
Because in some cases, the application involves comparing an image that is taken on the spot with some fixed image that the government may have in its possession, that is to say, your passport photo. And from what I've seen in my own experience in traveling back when you could travel, these were really not very high resolution situations at all. In fact, I was surprised they even used that stuff to match people.
Right. So, you know, historically, passport images were required to fit on the chip that was put on the passport, sort of mandated by ICAO. Today, those chips are bigger and faster. But obviously, we have legacy images sitting in passports for a 10-year period, typically. They're very well posed photos, but they are often a little bit too compressed and a bit too small in terms of resolution. So we can do better. There are sort of standardization processes to try and drive things in that direction. And that would actually help the twin situation also. Because if you look at fine detail on a face, then twins can be distinguished.
Sure, because if you know twins, you can distinguish them. Once you get to know them, you can tell which one is which. And with respect to the eye question, in some situations, do you need, as NIST identified, you might need a higher level of resolution and accuracy, say in international travel, where the stakes can be very big, versus access to buildings and facilities on a routine basis? Are there differentials that are permitted in those types of systems in terms of accuracy?
Yeah, so access control is one thing. You set your security levels accordingly. The sort of the larger market segment is one to many applications. So, you know, these big systems that look for people in databases. So if you've been previously deported from a country, you might look at face recognition to detect somebody traveling under a different document, or trying to execute driving license fraud, for example, or visa fraud. Those one-to-many applications are a bit more stressful on face recognition because they, in principle, can operate on databases in, you know, tens of millions of people. So your tolerance for mistakes, false positive mistakes, is lower is in those cases. The requirements, the accuracy requirements, are more stringent.
Patrick Rother is a computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We'll return with more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer for men, but African-American men are more at risk. That's primarily because it's often diagnosed when it's more advanced. The good news is that diagnosed early, most prostate cancer can be treated effectively. If you're a man over 50 or have a family history of prostate cancer, talk to your doctor today about a test. For more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Welcome back to our interview with Patrick Grother, computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Our topic is biometrics and the application of facial recognition. And you mentioned that the high resolution is coming into the picture here, so to speak, no pun intended, and also that can't bet against the developers. They are making progress. Is the progress coming in because of better cameras and better resolution, or can the algorithm software be improved, or is there some element of artificial intelligence that's being added to the algorithms? Where are the accuracy gains coming from at this point?
Substantially, it's coming from AI research, right? So different ways of building neural networks, particularly to do deep learning. And how that happens is the algorithms are finding features in faces, and we don't necessarily understand what those features are, but the algorithms are being trained to do that. So they will find information in a face that they can exploit for the purposes of more reliable identity determination. And high resolution will afford an algorithm different opportunities or better opportunities to do that.
So in other words, there might be, to use a fingerprint term, minutiae in the face that we don't even know about, but that the software is able to discern?
Yeah, in principle, yes.
That sounds like a major development, actually, in anatomy.
Right. So if we go back to 2004, a French company found out that skin texture, the sort of the fine detailed texture on your forehead and on your cheeks, is a biometric and was capable of distinguishing between twins. But it requires higher resolution than it than was and is typical to be able to see that texture reliably and consistently and to know that that texture is there. And so those algorithms exist. We know the information is there, but it hasn't really been exploited. We know the sensors, the cameras that are in use are capable of acquiring that information quite easily. And yet the industry hasn't actually gone there as a matter of course in sort of biometric.
So the labs and the researchers are a little bit ahead of the industry as deployed, basically.
Yeah. And of course, we always have the problem of legacy photos sitting in databases, sitting on passports that aren't what you would call up to a future standard.
Got it. And so that leads to the question of something you mentioned early, and that is NIST is working on quality assessment standards. Tell us what those are and what some of the work being done is.
Right. So this has been a driver in all sorts of biometrics for decades, that an understanding that if you throw poor samples in, you'll get poor recognition results out. So garbage in, garbage out. And so there's been a drive in fingerprints and in iris and in face recognition to collect better images. You can do that via building better cameras. So that is done for fingerprints. It's done for irises. Or you can write documentary standards that instruct photographers on how to take photos. But what we've started to do is to evaluate automated algorithms, potentially built on AI, that look at an image and say, is this the kind of image we're looking for? Is this essentially conformant to the standards? Is it capable of providing utility to a recognition engine, a face recognition algorithm? And that's quite non-trivial, because the sort of the universe of things that can go wrong when we take a face photo is quite large in terms of the camera properties, in terms of how the subject behaves in front of the camera.
Yeah, so that means for some of the forensic applications, for example, you might have some real problems if someone is deceased and you cannot obtain an updated image and you're working from, say, an old Instamatic print or something with low resolution, then you could only go as far as you could go.
Yeah, there's certain things that you can't fix. So you can't, in your example, you can't require a different presentation from that person. But also in the whole field of non-cooperative biometrics, if you're just observing an entrance into a hospital or something quite passively, and you want to know who's coming and going, then there are certain things you don't control, and the consequences could be recognition outcomes that aren't what you expect.
So you're updating one of the publications on quality assessment now. Is that what you said?
So we have currently, I think, six different publications that come from our four ongoing benchmarks. And those reports we will update in December, I think four of them, on quality, on one-to-one verification accuracy, on one-to-many search accuracy, and on the face mask status. Yep.
Got it. And what do you hear from agencies and what do you hear from industry as their top concerns? What do they want you to find out for them or establish for them at NIST?
You know, universally, we get good feedback that we provide a level of transparency into the technology that is sort of lacking in other fields. And so we get some credit for that. Universally, I think people want these reports that we write to be accessible. So to explain the technology, explain the factors, and support a wider use of the technology by giving visibility to it. You know, the reports that we put out are useful in sort of two high-level ways. One is in documenting absolute capability of the technology. How well can it work in certain setting? And then relative accuracy, which algorithms are working better, or which compression techniques are working better, or which cameras in principle, if we have that information. If you don't measure things, then you don't really know what the underlying situation is.
And do you find that industry tends to share breakthroughs and standards, or do these algorithms end up as proprietary property, even patented perhaps, and therefore something revolutionary or something new may not make it across industry?
So pretty much all biometric algorithms are closed source and heavily encumbered by intellectual property. Obviously, academia does a lot of work on face recognition. They typically are constrained by the amount of data that they have for development. There have been quite capable algorithms submitted to our ongoing benchmark, and they are open to the world to download and look at. They're not really products. They are just sort of existence proofs or proofs of concept that a particular neural network approach can work.
Patrick Rother is a computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We'll return for the third and final segment of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer for men. African-American men are more at risk. That's primarily because it's often diagnosed when it's more advanced. The good news is that diagnosed early, most prostate cancer can be treated effectively. If you're a man over 50 or have a family history of prostate cancer, talk to your doctor today about a test. For more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Welcome back to our interview with Patrick Rother, computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And let's talk about the demographic question, because that gets into many issues of bias and so forth in algorithms. And I think you said on a panel a couple of years ago that one of the problems is simply finding sufficient numbers of test subject databases of faces, that almost every one available has been used repeatedly in all of the testing and development. What's the situation there now?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a U.S. government perspective, we are privileged to, have access to some very large databases from U.S. government partners that we collaborate with. But from a developer's perspective, they are often constrained by the amount of image data that they have, and particularly in terms of its demographic balance. So, different developers operating in different countries may have some access to some customer data, but typically they won't. So they're dependent on some academic databases, some databases that they've gleaned from the internet, and they do development efforts, within their closed laboratories, and they don't typically publish what they do. But demographic balance has been a problem, and it has been talked about by some of the developers. And it seems necessary with AI developed technology to have, you know, diverse training data.
Yes, because I guess the question of whether algorithms are accurate on black faces has been an ongoing issue. And what is the issue with that technically? Because a face is a face, and the difference is skin brightness, but skin reflectance is actually similar no matter what the person's racial makeup is. How is the world addressing that particular situation?
Right. So, you know, this whole discussion sort of kicked off 2017, you know, quite prominently, because MIT ran a study, not of face recognition, but of algorithms that look at an image and say, are you male or female? And they noted a very poor accuracy from some leading cloud providers of sex estimation algorithms. They noted poor accuracy in African politicians' female faces. So, you know, 40% error rate of guessing the wrong sex. And, you know, that was a cautionary tale that some of these technologies can give poor accuracy on particular demographic groups. When we repeated this in face recognition, we wrote a report 2019 that said that false negative rates, how often an algorithm can't associate a photo of me with me, those false negative rates were very, very, very good. So very low false negative rates, even in dark-skinned individuals. And you know, the effect was quite small. It was nothing like the effect that MIT had seen for those sex estimation algorithms. What we did find is that the algorithms are a bit more variable and in terms of false positive effect. So they would confuse two Asian faces or two African faces much more frequently than they would in, say, white European male faces. So we saw those false positive differentials, and they have implications for access control into a phone or into a passport system, you know, a border crossing system, and also in one-to-many search systems.
So that would seem to mitigate then in favor of the newer algorithms that have artificial intelligence and those that are able to see minutiae in faces that the naked eye cannot perceive. That would seem that those non-white faces then would do better and better under those types of systems.
Right. So face recognition and algorithms have been developed to be tolerant of sort of distracting information, like the exact orientation of the head or whether the eyes are closed or whether you're wearing glasses, and also the illumination differences. So if you have sunlight on one side of the face and shadow on the other side of the face, algorithms have been developed to be tolerant of that. And so the skin tone issue doesn't really seem to affect false negative effects. That's what I said, that those demographic differentials are quite small. The false positive differentials, on the other hand, are probably something to do with the shape of the face. So if an algorithm has been developed on a data set that is impoverished with respect to, say, Asians, then we don't see it doing well on Asian faces in terms of false positives.
So that's a training issue in some ways, an algorithm training issue.
Right, a training issue, and that depends on availability of representative data to the developer.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for January, Digital Transformation Month, sponsored by NEC Corporation on Federal News Network.